And the list of three-letter acronyms that can start an argument, GMO, is right up there with KKK. We will focus on farming in this hour and leave white supremacy out of it. Our guest is a farmer with long experience with GMO, genetically modified organisms. Howard Vlieger comes from a farming family in Iowa, but spends a lot of his time traveling the country talking about his perceptions of agriculture and GMO. He's on a tour right now visiting Fortuna and Eureka on Monday and Ashland on Tuesday, and he's here right now on The Exchange to talk about his findings and suggestions for how to move ahead. Howard Vlieger, thanks for joining us today.
Good morning, sir. Thank you for having me on the program.
I understand you still live on the very farm where you were born, is that right?
Yes, sir.
And so how many generations does farming go back in your family?
Well, on one side it's three, and on the other side it's four.
All right, so quite a long existence with the Vliegers and their predecessors. You call yourself a student of the soil, Howard. What does that mean?
Well, to me it means a never-ending learning experience. The soil is, the good Lord gave us an amazing creation to work with, and it's a never-ending and exciting journey to continue to learn more about it and share that information with others to help them be more successful in working with the soil instead of against it for better crop production.
That's an interesting concept that seems to be a more modern one, to think about actually working with the soil instead of, as you put it, working against it.
Well, the production agriculture mainstream seems to have focused more on the sustainability of the companies that sell the products for crop production than the sustainability of the soil and the farmers who are involved in the crop production. And it's really neat what can happen when you learn to work with it.
Give us an example of a way that you changed procedures that might have existed in previous generations of farming on that land, and things you just said, you know, let's try this instead.
Well, in 1989, I started using what was termed as alternative farming practices then. Today, we call it biological crop production. And our focus is to use as small amount of anything that is damaging to the beneficial microbial community in the soil. The soil should be rich and abundant with a wide diversity of microorganisms and living components, and many of the products that are used in mainstream crop production can have either a partial effect or a devastating effect to the microorganisms. And working with the biology in the soil, as well as the elemental mineral content of the soil, and getting them all in balance results in more efficient crop production and a vastly higher quality of produce and forage and crops produced from that soil.
So, Howard Vlieger, is biological crop production organic, or is it something beyond organic? I mean, where does it sort of fall on that continuum?
The term organic, as everyone recognizes it, can fall under that, all aspects of it. I work with farmers that are in the mainstream production that are seeing significant problems that they're not finding answers to the questions and problems that they have. The full biological approach and the organic approach. And I guess the biological approach is when you recognize that you do have to focus on improving the biological diversity, all of the aspects of the soil food web. I won't spell that all out because it's somewhat confusing with the terminology, but let's compare it to your stomach. You eat food, and if you don't have good bugs in your stomach to digest that food, you get no nutrition out of the food. If you don't have good bugs in your stomach and you get a bad bug, then you don't feel well. The same thing can be applied to the soil. We need to have good bugs to have the system functioning right and have everybody feel good.
All right. So, but the idea then that might have once existed where I was like, oh, let's get rid of all this stuff. I mean, we don't want any bacteria, any bugs, any of that stuff. I mean, the fact is you really need a really intricate web of life coming together to make things successful in the soil.
Absolutely, and both in the soil and in the health of mammals, whether it's four-legged or two-legged, the thing that's becoming more and more obvious in numerous scientific studies that have been conducted and published and are in the process of being published, you know, there's a big concern about antibiotic-resistant bacteria. Well, what's the answer? Well, the answer we're finding in many, many cases is a good bug that will overpower the bad bug that the antibiotics cannot control.
Something like humans and probiotic foods?
Exactly. That's an example. You know, increasing, for example...
You're still there. We missed the end of your sentence. I'm sorry.
I didn't know what that was. You know, the more good bugs you have in your stomach, the better your digestive system works and the healthier you feel.
All right, we'll get into the heart of the discussion about GMO or genetically engineered crops when we come back and talk more with Howard Vlieger again. He'll be in Fortuna on Monday at 1 o'clock, in Eureka on Monday at 6 o'clock, and in Ashland at the Southern Oregon University Rogue River Room at Stevenson Union on Tuesday, 7:30 to 9 in the evening. Howard Vlieger coming to the area, talking to us by phone here on The Exchange Now, and you can join this discussion when we come back from a break. Howard Vlieger and you in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. We're talking to Howard Vlieger, a longtime farmer from Iowa. He was actually born on the very farm where he still lives, and he has done a lot of research over the years into the effects of different things on the soil. And he calls himself a student of the soil. He's studied a lot about GMOs, genetically modified organisms, and their effects on the soil and the critters that consume them. This is a conversation very much in demand. Howard will be in Fortuna and in Eureka on Monday and in Ashland on Tuesday. We're getting an advanced look at what he's talking about. Join us here on The Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Howard, there's a lot of you on YouTube, you probably are aware, and I had a chance to look at some earlier talks you gave, one in which you mentioned that you first really became aware of GMO in 1994. What was the exposure?
Well, I was in the crop advisory field. I started giving advice to interested farmers in 1992 on the alternative crop production methods. I was also a seed dealer for a seed company at that point in time. And when I heard about the coming introduction of the genetically engineered crops, I thought, you know, I need to find out as much as I can about them and be abreast of what they will do. I went online. I started doing searches. There was one website, actually at Colorado State University, that at that time that was very informative about how the genetically engineered crops were produced and actually developed in the laboratory. And it appeared to me to be a very inexact science. And at that point in time, I wasn't communicating with all of the tremendous scientists that I'm privileged to work with today, that they later confirmed that not only is it an inexact science, the way that it's being implemented in the current genetically engineered crops we have in production in our country, it's in fact dirty science because it is such an unnatural process. And that being said, I want to emphasize that myself nor the scientists that I'm privileged to work with are against the technology itself, because genetic engineering, when it's implemented and perfected and cleaned up and utilized to its optimum capability, is a very good tool. And we have an example of that in the production of insulin for diabetes patients in our country. But the process which they're using in the crop production is very inexact. They need numerous things as infection agents and mechanisms to instigate the activity that they're inserting into that crop, and it's because it's such an unnatural process and they have not perfected it in any way, shape, or form, plus they're not implementing it in the way they profess it's to be used. They say, well, we're going to increase yield and we're going to improve the nutrient content of the crop. Well, there's zero results and evidence of that to this point in time. The things that they have done, which they claim that they're going to reduce pesticide use by this technology, has in fact been just the opposite. The primary application of genetic engineering to the crops that we've seen in this point in time has dramatically increased the amount of pesticide that is used in a long-term manner relative to crop production.
So to understand that, I mean, this makes you a bit different from some of the other people who talk about GMOs and will undertake tours like yours to talk about them. And you're saying that this actually can be useful science for us, but not the way it's done right now.
I am all for the concepts and the science of genetic engineering if and when they utilize it like they profess that it can be done, and perfect it. And again, I was privileged when I was in Washington State in September to meet two retired molecular microbiologists, one from Washington State University that worked in the lab doing the genetic insertions, and another one that came from the medical field and was involved in the genetic engineering in the insulin production. And they were very gracious in explaining this in a manner that made sense. The way it's being used in crop production, you have in a 1 in a trillion to a 1 in 100 trillion chance of putting this insertion in the same place twice. And the reason that's so important is every time it's put in a different location within the plant, it has the potential to disrupt the normal DNA makeup of that plant in a fashion that is going to establish a foreign protein in the fruit of that plant. And this concern about the foreign proteins is much overlooked by many in the field because, well, they say, well, we tested this protein or we looked in the scientific literature and this protein that we've inserted has no allergenistic effect, but that's wrong. They've tested only the protein they've inserted. They have done no testing on the resultant new proteins that will be coming from the production of this plant as a result of this inexact insertion. And the scientists that have done the premier research on this, independent research, this foreign protein aspect has always been a vital concern. And one of the first studies that was ever conducted in the world on this showed a significant direct challenge to the immune system of the animals that were fed the genetically engineered crop. And, you know, when you challenge the immune system of a mammal, everything kind of tumbles down as the immune system suffers.
So if I can characterize the general concerns about GMO, they tend to work in two strains. Number one, what will it do to me, my health, the health of any animals that consume it? Number two, what will it do to our ability to grow healthy crops? And I think I hear you saying you have both concerns.
Exactly.
And I also hear a parallel with what you were talking about earlier about being a student of the soil and how people work against the soil. The way you describe GMO and the inexactness of what you see there, it sounds like they're working against the plants as well.
The natural processes that if you work with them and really allow you to maximize efficiency and quality of crop production are disrupted in a significant way with this chemical intervention, viral intervention that they're doing with the genetically engineered crops as they are currently implemented in wide-scale production in our country.
Howard Vlieger is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a much-in-demand speaker, farmer, student of the soil, long-term studier of GMOs, genetically modified organisms, or genetically engineered crops and their effects on critters and themselves. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Brian in Ashland, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Well, hi. I wanted to talk about the elephant in the room here in Jackson County, and that's Measure 15119. Howard's coming here to help support that initiative, and the issue there is really about the health of our economy and the impact of GMOs. And Howard mentioned he's not against GMO per se, but I wanted to point out the initiative has an exception for medical and scientific research. It doesn't ban GMOs. It just bans GMO crops and their impact on our farmers. So people should, a lot of people don't know that subtle difference. And the other thing, too, is the fight here is being driven by outside interests. Yesterday, $40,000 from three sugar companies was delivered to the local Farm Bureau for their phony group called Good Neighbor Farmers. Okay, outside interests, including foreign corporations who plant their seeds here, are trying to own our valley. You need to vote yes on 15119.
Yeah, which is, again, it would ban genetically modified crops just within Jackson County, and that's on the May ballot, is that right?
Correct, May 2014. And thanks for the show. I appreciate the opportunity to speak.
All right, thanks for that, Brian. Appreciate it. Which raises the larger question, Howard Vlieger, if we are going to be regulating GMOs, and perhaps more than we already do, what's the logical level at which that regulation should take place? Because here we're talking about a county ballot measure.
Well, all of the country, many of the countries, I should say, around the world have implemented the proper scientific approach to this manifest change in crop and food production. And that's the precautionary principle. You need to test this new product, which is going into the food supply, for all the potential adverse effects and prove that it's not going to have a devastating effect to the health of the people. The thing that's interesting about the genetically engineered crop is not only do we have the fundamental change to the food supply and the protein makeup of the food itself, but now you have a piggyback, which is equally concerning and in many cases more concerning, that being the dramatically expanded use of glyphosate-based herbicides. And last year, worldwide, it was estimated that there was 880 million pounds of glyphosate-based herbicides applied. The thing that people don't realize is, you know, that glyphosate-based herbicides, which were first registered in 1974 under the brand name Roundup, the science on the safety of that herbicide is very ancient in terms of the toxicity and the significant damage that it can cause. Some of the studies are 40 years old that they looked at the, you know, does this have an effect or not? Well, the current science shows a dramatic effect from two aspects. First of all, well, three aspects, actually. First of all, glyphosate's a very broad-spectrum chelator. A chelator, chelate is a Greek word meaning claw or to hold, and it tightly binds and ties up a wide number of nutrients or minerals wherever it's present. Calcium, magnesium, manganese, zinc, iron, copper, nickel, cobalt, boron, selenium, molybdenum, and potassium. Wherever the glyphosate is present, it will attach and bind up those minerals so they're not available. Glyphosate is also a very strong biocide or antibiotic. It was patented in 2010. There's a patent on the U.S. patent website, patent number 7771736. That documents that glyphosate is a very strong antibiotic. There's been significant research published by USDA Ag Research scientists documenting the fact that glyphosate has a devastating effect to many beneficial microorganisms in the soil, which subsequently allows the opportunistic or bad organisms to increase in number. As they increase in number, the diseases that are caused by the bad organisms increase, many of them fungal diseases. As your fungal diseases increase, now you have to increase the use of fungicide in order to try and control the disease that's in place. And the diseases increase the presence of mold and mycotoxins in the grain and feed and food supply. On top of that, you have the fact that glyphosate is a very strong endocrine disruptor. In essence, what that damage causes to a fetus in the womb, it spells birth defects in varying degrees. And there's been numerous studies that are showing this strong endocrine disrupting capability of the glyphosate. In adults, your cells need to die and reform and regenerate in your body every day. When an endocrine disruptor enters your system, you have abnormal cells. What's an abnormal cell develop into? A tumor.
All right, so much to think about there. Let's take a phone call here from Carol and Selma. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about farming and GMOs with Howard Vlieger.
Hi. I want to thank Howard for his really clear explanations of all these scientific aspects. And I work with GMO-free Josephine County. I want to let the listeners in Josephine County know that Howard Vlieger will also be giving two presentations in Josephine County this coming week on Tuesday the 28th at 2 p.m. in Williams at Plaisance Ranch and in Grants Pass at 3 p.m. at Roque Community College in the Roque Building.
So 2 o'clock in Williams and 3 o'clock in Grants Pass?
Yes.
Okay.
And there is information on our website at gmofreejosephinecounty.org.
All right. Thank you for that. So Tuesday at 2 in Williams and at 3 o'clock at RCC, and then, of course, still that night as well at Ashland. So
yes.
Thank you for that, Carol. And
so people don't have to travel too far from home.
All right. Sounds good. You've got quite a busy schedule, Howard. I mean, how many different cities do you hit over the course of a year in talking about farming and GMOs?
I don't know. I haven't kept track.
Fair enough. Elsewhere in Josephine County, here's Carter in Wolf Creek. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Howard Vlieger.
Yes, good morning. I'm thinking as I'm listening to this program about the quote from Einstein that now about atomic power and energy, that now that the atom power of the atom has been unleashed, except for the way that we think, we drift toward unparalleled catastrophes, and you certainly have laid out a number of those, and I would be interested in anything more you have to say about what kind of catastrophes, in addition to what you've already mentioned, you would expect from this technology. And a specific question that I would have, I know a lot about this Roundup thing. I've been involved with that issue for over 30 years. And my understanding is that the glyphosate molecule itself isn't such a big problem as the surfactant materials that are gathered up from surplus from the chemical industries, and they just throw anything they want to in there, and those materials are the ones that are really toxic.
All right. Thanks for that, Carter. Appreciate it. So your thoughts,
yep.
Howard?
Well, there are numerous adjuvants or surfactants that will be used with different chemicals. There are also inert ingredients in chemicals, which there's no oversight or understanding whatsoever of what's included in the inert. Glyphosate is probably the most researched chemical that we have seen to this point in time in science. And there's a simple fact of why it's been so researched. The amount of damning evidence that is accumulated justifies more and more and more research. There's also research that has focused on the glyphosate surfactant in Roundup, which is POEA. In several scientific studies that I'm aware of, the POEA did prove to be more damaging than the glyphosate itself. So the combination of the two shows significant reason for serious attention and reevaluation of whether or not this product is allowed to be used.
But once something's already approved, it's not really likely to get pulled back from the market, is it? I mean, it's a lot harder at that point?
There is a reevaluation time period on all chemicals that are registered with the different regulatory agencies around the world.
All right, we'll pick it up there on the other side of a break. We're talking to Howard Vlieger, farmer and studier of GMOs, student of the soil. He'll come back and talk more with us about GMOs and other issues facing agriculture. Take your phone calls and emails as well. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today, Howard Vlieger, Iowa farmer of many generations and student of the soil, as he puts it. He travels the country talking about issues facing agriculture, farming, the soil, and particularly with a focus on GMOs, genetically modified organisms or genetically engineered, your choice. You can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange to talk to Howard ahead of his visits to the region next week. He'll be in Fortuna and Eureka on Monday. He'll be in Williams, Grants Pass, and Ashland on Tuesday. And you can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Email address jx@jeffnet.org. Howard, we were just talking about your perception of the toxicity of glyphosate or Roundup. And the fact that once things get to market, they actually can go through a reevaluation process. Has that been proposed, and is there a lot of interference here because of the large amount of money that Monsanto makes on the product and therefore probably some political power that gets wielded too?
Well, I'm not extremely up to date with the specifics of this reevaluation process. I know from different communications that I receive from colleagues from around the world that reviews of the glyphosate-based herbicides and or Roundup formulation, which since the patent is off Roundup, there's lots and lots and lots of glyphosate-based herbicides produced in countries all over the world. I know that it's coming up for review in places like Canada and some of the European Union countries, as well as the United States, in the next, let's say, 5 to 10 year time period. The thing that is critically important is that they look at the up-to-date science, because the recent science on this has been very, very, very consistent. There's publications that have shown that glyphosate induces the growth of breast cancer cells at part per trillion levels. As of the 1st of May in 2013, the EPA increased the allowable tolerance of glyphosate residue in virtually everything in our crop and food and feed supply that has a glyphosate tolerance level. They raised those levels to as high as 40 parts per million in grain and 400 parts per million in forages that would be fed to livestock. And they're, as far as damage to the beneficial microorganisms that are necessary for health of animals and or people, because the good bugs in the animal gut are the same good bugs we need to have in our gut, it only takes a tenth of a part per million of glyphosate residue to significantly damage or completely wipe out these beneficial organisms. So you might say that the 40-year-ago science, and of course we didn't have the capabilities to measure or administer these minute amounts at that point in time. There's definitely got to be a serious review of this. It reminds me of the potential threat to the mammals, the mammal community, and the environment. is probably more significant than what DDT was.
Wow, that's saying a lot. Let us take another call. Here's Jim in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Howard Vlieger.
Yes, good morning. I would urge everybody to look up agricultural industrial complex and see the ramifications the same as military industrial complex. The total immersion of what your guest is talking about in the waters of the world, the 30 to 35% of what we are claiming to be global warming is a result of agricultural industrial complex, you know, from the burning of rainforests to overproducing chemicals, both to put in the ground and to kill things. But that new phrase, or not so new, but agricultural industrial complex, I think might wake a few people up.
All right. Thanks for that, Jim. Appreciate it. Do you share that thought, Howard, about the agricultural industrial complex?
I guess I'm not directly familiar with that exact term, but the adverse effects of the glyphosate are not just realized in strictly production agriculture, because it's used by our park systems, our school systems, the transportation departments. It's so vastly used because the misperception of it being a quote-unquote non-toxic, friendly chemical is so extreme, and the potential for remediation and degradation of the compound by the microorganisms is challenging, if not extremely slow to happen. In some science, in the right soil conditions, the half-life has been identified as much as 22 and a half years of the compound.
From one spraying? 22 years?
22 and a half years half-life.
Wow.
So, and there's further research being conducted on that. I know of one specific research project that I cannot mention that they have zero breakdown and degradation of any of the glyphosate residue that's applied in a given year. A year later, 100% of it is there.
You say you can't discuss it. Is that because the study's not finished?
The study's not finished, and you know, it's because of my good fortune of being friends with one of the researchers that I'm even aware of it.
All right, let's take another call. Here's Val in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Howard Vlieger.
Thank you, Howard and Jeff. I do plan to vote against GMOs, mainly because I just don't think that genetic material should be patented or patentable. But I was wondering about your claim that genes, when they're inserted on the chromosome in a different location, that they produce a foreign protein. I think science right now is telling us that that's not possible, that it can only produce itself, reproduce itself, and send it out for circulation.
All right, let's pick it up there. Thanks for the call, Val. Appreciate it. Howard, where do you? What's your knowledge on that?
I received my... it's an ongoing education, but Dr. Arpad Pusztai was the first person to introduce me to this concept of that potential foreign protein establishment with this technology as it is currently utilized. And first of all, I'm firmly of the belief that the good Lord is the only one that knows the role and the functions of every component of the DNA and RNA in that structure. They're tinkering with things that they cannot specifically and precisely control in the way that they're doing it, and they don't have full knowledge of it. And because of the very lax regulatory statements that were initiated on this in our country in 1992 by the FDA, there's no requirement for safety testing. And the longest safety testing that's ever been conducted from the industry standpoint on animals is 90 days. Well, an independent research team took that 90-day study, extended it out to a 24-month or two-year time period, expanded on the scope of it by introducing the Roundup in the drinking water at below legal tolerant levels in some of the control or the test group animals, and they had just horrendous results to the health of the animals. The industry study stopped at 3 months or 90 days. In the 24-month study, in the 4 to 7 month time period, tumors started to develop in the lab animals that were consuming the genetically engineered corn and or drinking the minuscule amount of Roundup in their water. 50% of the males and 70% of the females died prematurely in that study. There was a two-thirds rate of tumor development in the animals. Now, the study was not set up initially to be a cancer study. It was a toxicology study, so it had the right number of animals in each control group. But the study was criticized because they didn't have enough animals for a cancer study, but they didn't anticipate that going into it. The study needs to be repeated, and sooner than later, and put the large number of animals in the groups, put 50 in each group, and you'll have the accurate number. But the industry studies, they have never used more than 20 per group. In a lot of cases, they'll use 5 per group. And in many cases, their protocol will not even look for the proper assessment of a negative effect. And when they have a negative effect show up in the blood work that they'll do, they'll discard it as being non-concerning when it is in fact just the opposite and say, well, this is safe, let's go ahead and approve it. So there's no cautionary principle that has been applied to the implementation and testing, safety testing, on the genetically engineered crops in the United States.
We've got about 4 minutes left, and we'll try to get a few more calls in here. Let's go to Mark in Redding. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Howard Vlieger.
Good morning. What chance do we have to keep these genetically modified crops that already exist from contaminating the non-genetically modified crops of the same thing, like, you know, soybeans, mm-hmm. corn?
So, yeah, how
I understand that's been spreading all over the place since the GMO plants have been coming in. What can we do to prevent this?
All right. Thanks, Mark. Howard?
There is absolutely clean seed yet available. The one of the big things that I see as a huge fallacy from a legal standpoint in this whole contamination is the fact that when the foreign or the genetically engineered crop is transferred into a non-genetically engineered field by wind, by animals, by pollinators, by whatever the case may be. Years ago, if you had cattle, and you had, let's say you have a registered cattle herd, and your neighbor has a commercial cattle herd, your neighbor's fence is in ill repair, and the bull from the neighbor gets in with your purebred herd, and subsequently breeds your cows, you had the right to recoup damages because of that damage of his animal to your high-quality animal. The courts are wrong as the day is long in the way that they have administered this thing. They did it just the opposite. The genetically engineered crop needs to be required to stay where it's supposed to be. It's not the fault of the man who doesn't want to buy it and doesn't want to raise it. That's one thing that has to be corrected. I don't know how to change it right now, but it's wrong the way it's been implemented.
We've got a final question here from Kathy in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Howard Vlieger.
Yeah, hi. I'm wondering, since there's a problem with requiring increased pesticides when you're using GMO seeds, why it is that farmers are still using GMO seeds. One theory I've heard is that they signed some kind of agreement with Monsanto, and sort of they're stuck in this agreement for a number of years once they get started. And another theory that I've heard is that maybe initially they use less pesticides, and then they get kind of stuck in this loop.
All right, let's get a response. Thanks for the call. Appreciate that, Kathy.
that is correct. In the beginning, the initial use may decrease as far as the amount of herbicide required. The question I would have is, all of the farmers, have they read all of the fine print on the back of the contract that they sign when they buy the seed that spells out all of the minute details, which are very strict and concerning relative to the use of this crop? Because I read it way back in the beginning in 1996. I know it's become much more comprehensive and invasive to the rights of the farmer since then, and there's no way I would ever sign one.
Howard Vlieger has been our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He'll be talking about GMOs and other issues facing agriculture. Got a couple of stops, more than a couple, around the region coming up next week. He'll be at the Rohnert Grange in Fortuna at 1 o'clock on Monday, at the Humboldt Hill Grange in Eureka at 6 o'clock on Monday. He'll be at Plaisance Farm in Williams Tuesday at 2 o'clock, at Rogue Community College not far away in Grants Pass at 3 o'clock on Tuesday. And then he'll finish up Tuesday with an appearance at the Rogue River Room at Stevenson Union at the Southern Oregon University campus at 7:30 in the evening, sponsored by GMO-Free Humboldt, GMO-Free Jackson, GMO-Free Josephine, and a bunch of other organizations. Howard Vlieger, a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me on your program.
You bet.
Big day.
Monday on the Jefferson Exchange at 8 o'clock, we'll talk about boosting business in Southern Oregon with So Ready. We'll talk about pesticide stewardship partnerships. And then at 9 o'clock, we'll talk about emergency preparedness with a summit coming up in Springfield next week. That's all Monday on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer is Charlotte Duren. Our student assistant at the controls today, Reed Newland. I'm Jeffrey Riley. We do hope you join us again Monday at 8 for another edition of the Jefferson Exchange here on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. And please, have a great weekend.